This is an Enterprise Times podcast. My name is Ian Murphy. I'm here with Rob Sinfield from Sage.
Good afternoon, everybody. My name is Rob Sinfield. I am Vice President of Product for the Enterprise Management Solution delivered by Sage into the marketplace. The product itself is available in over 80 countries around the world. We have over 6,000 customers across manufacturing and distribution and agriculture using the application. We deliver end-to-end capabilities for manufacturing, distribution, and 18 other industry verticals.
You've just released a report titled Riding the Wave of Uncertainty, Looking at Manufacturing Around the World. Can you give us a quick précis of that?
The report that you refer to, Riding the Wave of Uncertainty, was something that Sage commissioned together with IDC. We interviewed 900 different individuals in primarily process manufacturing organizations across the US, the UK, and Canada. The split was roughly equal in terms of just over 300 participants from each of the various countries that I mentioned. The focus of the report was really to try and understand how companies are managing the risk and uncertainty that we have at the moment. There are four primary takeaways from the report, one being that, surprisingly, there's a lot of positivity in all three of those regions about manufacturing. The second takeaway is really focused on what is the impact of legislative change, compliance change, and the uncertainty that we see from a macroeconomic perspective. The third area that it highlighted and identified is around the skills gap in the marketplace or how we manage that skills gap in the marketplace. And the fourth area that the report really highlighted and identified is the use of technologies or disruptive technologies such as blockchain to address things like provenance and traceability.
I'd like to start and look about that skill shortage because it's a common problem that we're seeing at the moment. Manufacturing over the years has been key in leading apprenticeships. But in the last 20 years in the UK, we've seen the butchering of vocational training. We've seen spikes in apprenticeships, but actually we've seen a fall off in the last year or so as a lot of large engineering companies in particular have slowed down their use of apprenticeships and bringing people on. If we're going to fix the skills gap, where do we start with bringing people in? Do we need better vocational training? Do we need a better relationship with schools? What is it we need to look at to be able to rebuild that skills ramp?
I think fundamentally to remedy that skills gap, we almost need to take a step backwards and look at education as a whole. I think education has become rather skewed towards book learning rather than practical learning. There are schools that are now starting to adopt programs where they're teaching children how to program with Python and other technology. But in general, I think the challenge is the way that we educate children as a whole. The question of education as a whole is fundamental to this. It's how we provide children with education. We're too often telling them instead of actually showing them and giving them the skills to repeat those things and take them into industry. I think the other thing that we need to do is take a look at the way that industry delivers apprenticeships. One of the challenges that we have with the way that apprenticeships are delivered is that there's a bit of a stigma associated with going into an apprenticeship. Even today, it's seen as, well, you don't have the ability to go and pursue a degree. Whereas what we need to do is change that stigma and show people that they can get involved in manufacturing and delivering great products and making Britain great. We need to be looking at things like gamification strategy and actually bringing that into the apprenticeship. Providing people with a baseline across the industry. You are a level one fitter, you're a level one joiner, you're a level one X, Y, and Z, and providing them with a career path to get to the next levels and the training that goes along with that. That needs to be backed up by government programs. It needs to be backed up by industry organizations supporting this and much, much better collaboration with universities. I think universities also need to take a look at their processes and programs and flip that. So I think it's a combination of these things. One is going back to the sort of primary level education and even secondary school level education, focusing much more on vocational teaching rather than just book learning. That needs to be accompanied with proper programs that can be delivered into the marketplace to allow people to see a career trajectory. And then link that into gamification strategy so that people can see, okay, this is my next level up, so I can compare with my peers. I've spoken to many recruits myself as to why did you get a degree? Well, because everybody else was getting a degree and I wanted to be on the same level as everybody as I'm competing with, which has led to a generation of professional students who study for 8, 10, 11 years before they actually enter the workforce. And by the time they get there, they don't necessarily have the skills to do what is required on a production shop floor.
But fixing this isn't easy. If we think about a change to the education system, that can take 10 years to filter through, because you have to change at the junior school level, into the secondary school level, into A-levels and potentially post-A-level. We've also had 25 years of setting an aspirational target of increasing the number of people with degrees, because the perception has been, in order to compete with places like Korea, the United States, India and other countries, we have to have degree-educated people, not skills-educated people. And that's kind of gone with the decline in British manufacturing. We've outsourced all those jobs we thought were lower quality jobs rather than actually embrace them and kept it here. Is there the political will, therefore, to look at changing manufacturing? And when you're talking to these companies, is there actually the business will to go to politicians and say, you must do this, not just from companies, but from their trade associations?
I'm not so sure about the political will. I don't know if that's something that we can quantify. I think there is the business will, though. I think businesses are starting to recognize that they need to address the skills gap. I look at programs that Sage, for example, is running. We've got apprenticeships across our organization, bringing in people from a variety of backgrounds, a variety of skill sets, and training them up, taking them from somebody who's come into the organization as a junior programmer and working them through so that they become an advanced program. It's not necessarily the same as manufacturers, but I certainly see the will there. We heard from Braymont Watches in the UK today about the apprenticeships that they're running, that they're open to anybody of all ages, of all creeds, races, colors, etc. And they bring them in and they do a bench test, test their skills within half an hour. You can see if they've got the necessary dexterity. Within an hour, you can see if they've got the aptitude for the job, etc., etc. In general, Generation Z has a bad reputation. We kind of associate them as just being a Twitter generation. We joke about the fact that if it's more than 140 characters, they won't necessarily be able to do that. But I think what they're doing is they're changing the way that we actually deliver training to them. They're changing the way that they consume things. So apprenticeships need to be able to move with that. Now, looking at British industry, I think British industry needs to take a step forward here, and they actually need to say, we are going to focus on apprenticeships. We are going to actively promote this and drive this forward. We're not going to see the same level of immigration taking place and things like that as a result of those macroeconomic factors that are having an impact on what we're trying to do. The industry itself needs to step forward. I think the industry associations, as you say, they need to stump up. Technology companies need to help deliver these sorts of vocational skills training programs as well, so that we provide the technology platforms to enable people to provide vocational skills and training. I think it's a collaborative effort. I don't think it's just the businesses themselves. I don't think it's individual businesses doing it, but we do need some major magnates of industry to really stand up and champion this. I think that would be a significant step forward.
You mentioned the watch company just now. One of the things that I picked up in the report reading it was it talks about artisan manufacturing. But one of the challenges here is that the moment we start to go down the artisan route, first of all, pricing and cost goes through the roof. Walk into your local cafe and order a cup of coffee. Now walk into your local coffee shop and order the same coffee and see a doubling, trebling, quadrupling of price for the same product. Moving into a phase in the country where the amount of disposable income is going to be low for a period of time, both for businesses and for individuals. How do we support an artisan industry if the money isn't there in the general economy to pay higher pricing for goods? Because we've become used to mass produce cheap goods, and having outsourced that to countries like China and Vietnam and everybody else, we can't even begin to compete on price with those countries.
It's a really fine balancing act between developing an artisanal economy and balancing against what we have as sort of mass-produced materials. Where the artisanal economy is going to come to the forefront is when we start to look at this idea of built in Britain, made in Britain, British quality. People will start to identify that there's a premium associated with that. Artisanal doesn't necessarily have to mean low tech. I think that's the problem. A lot of people tend to associate artisanal with it's low tech, it's somebody sitting there and they're meticulously filing down a piece of wood. It could be that it's the craft that goes in behind it. Again, looking at Braymont, listen to their machining processes. They machine within 5 microns of accuracy. They don't have to do that, but they do that because it's a significant selling point for them. You're right, disposable income is potentially going to be less in the UK, but this is where there's a huge amount of opportunity for UK manufacturing to branch out. Yes, is it going to be more difficult with tariffs and things like that? For sure, you can't discount that, but there's such a heritage of innovation in this country. You look at automotive developments, you look at Formula One racing. Most of those companies have their hubs in the UK because the artisanal skills here are just so fantastic. In the UK, the artisanal skills are respected beyond anywhere else in the world. You marry that desire to deliver artisanal quality and that idea of innovation, that's where British companies can really start to set themselves apart from our counterparts. Yes, we will not be able to compete with the mass-produced capabilities that you will see in Vietnam and in China and in Thailand and places like that. But one of the things that did come out of the report was the fact that looking at these companies, they are seeing a drive to actually reshoring production because customers are prepared to pay more for this locally sourced, locally made, locally manufactured. And I think that is as a response to this idea of everything is disposable. Again, it ties into this idea of we're moving away from a linear economy where it was make, use, dispose, which is very cheap. You don't mind doing that if it's a cheap widget or something that you've paid a couple of quid for. But as soon as you start to add that artisanal element to it and there's more intrinsic value with it, you're much more willing to make it, use it, repair it, refurbish it, continue to use it for as long as you possibly can. And that might see people shifting. They may have less disposable income, but they'll save up a little bit longer to buy something that has more intrinsic value that will last longer than sort of that throwaway ideology that they've seen before.
Now, that's quite interesting. A couple of things you talked about there was quality. You talked about automotive. You also talked about onshoring. If we look at post-World War II, what changed things in Germany was productivity. And the UK's productivity is low compared to a lot of countries. If we look at what changed things in Japan, particularly in the automotive industry, was that Detroit outsourced manufacture of transmissions to Japan. What it discovered is American consumers were willing to wait an extra 6 months to get a Japanese transmission that was manufactured to exactly the same plans as an American one. And the difference when they investigated was where the Americans were working to 1/32nd, the Japanese were working to 1/64th. Where the Americans were working to 1/4-inch gap, the Japanese were working to 1/8 inch gap. It made for tighter, higher quality, more resilient product. How easy will it be to onshore and raise both the productivity and the quality standards, i.e. to almost mirror what happened in Germany and Japan, if we're going to rebuild manufacturing in that Greater Britain environment?
It's a really good question, and it's probably one that requires a little bit of a look at where Britain is being successful at the moment. Yes, we need to become more productive. That's definitely something that we have to focus on. And the way that we can do that is through technology adoption. The UK has traditionally been a little bit of a laggard in terms of technology adoption, certainly in manufacturing. You go into a lot of manufacturing plants today, it's still done the way it was 60 years ago. The machines that they have are still 60 years old. It's the same milling machines, it's the same stamping machines, etc., that they've used for 60 years. So I think there's definitely an investment there. And I know it's a tough time to be making investments, but we've got to find a balance there. That will hopefully lead to productivity, because one of the reasons why we have productivity is that these 60-year-old machines are starting to reach the end of their operational life. So they're probably down more often than they are actually fully operational and doing things. There's an investment curve that we have to go through for sure. The other thing that I think we need to do is in terms of how we drive this idea of delivering quality more into the environment is by looking at how we can, again, continue to innovate. I used the example of Formula One teams a little bit earlier. You look at the best gearboxes, they're made in the UK by UK manufacturers. And what they've done is they have come to a point where they're using the highest quality materials. They're sourcing those materials locally. They know exactly where they're coming from. They're not just accepting that, okay, we're getting a batch of whatever, because they want to make sure that they can trace and track everything. That is something that the UK needs to continue to do. If we look at the UK, I don't think we will necessarily get to a point where we are as efficient as X, Y, and Z. Not in the short term. It's going to take us probably a generation to get there in terms of driving that efficiency. But where we could set ourselves apart is looking at doing things differently. One of the challenges that the UK needs to address is not only delivering high-quality products that are done in a way that is optimal and efficient, but I think we need to really set the UK products apart from other products by saying we are delivering the value-added services that go with that product that really set us apart. It's a multifaceted approach that we need to take. The first part is, yes, we need to reshore products. We need to bring that expertise back. And that means that we need to address the skills gap. We need to invest in the machinery that we're using to make the products. We need to also invest in technology to drive some of those efficiencies. We've been indoctrinated to believe that robots are going to replace people. And there has been reports published by our very own Oxford University that has said that 40% of the UK workforce will be put out of work as we adopt robotics and things like that. The OECD has published new reports that indicate that it's probably more around 12 to 13% in the UK that will see robots replacing their jobs. That provides us with an opportunity to reuse those people who know the processes, they know the way that we make things. They can add value somewhere else in the organization. We get immediate efficiencies by taking that domain knowledge. They're the guys who can start the training programs. They're the people that can start to manage the adoption of some of these artisanal processes because they know how it was done 25 years ago, but using new technology to do it faster.
Capturing that domain knowledge has always been the challenge. We've moved through multiple phases of roboticizing plants, and we've never seen the job losses people have claimed. But one of the challenges in capturing that domain knowledge is actually being able to then utilize that information. Problem solving is a good example. I came across a cybersecurity attack where a set of water pumps were all set to maximum by an external attack. It forced an overload in the second and third pumps. An experienced engineer would have spotted that immediately because not all three pumps should have been open, but all three pumps were operating within their rules. And it's that difference between what the machine is set up for and those rules. If we then look at how we capture that, it takes us back to education and training. How do we retain that older workforce to do that education when a lot of the pressure is on bringing in younger people into the workforce?
The best example that I can give of this is actually practical experience that I saw myself, where there was a gentleman who was coming to the age of retirement and everybody was getting ready to put him out to pasture, so to say. Yes, he's going on retirement. Well done. Thank you very much. The managing director at the time, strangely enough, of a company that built pumps, took the approach that this was somebody who'd been building these pumps for 35 years. He'd started as an apprentice, he'd wound motors, and then he'd graduated onto other things, and he'd then started to mill impellers, and he'd then been responsible for assembly of pumps and putting these things together. And what they did for him was they actually created a role where he became a quality officer. And he was a quality officer for a couple of days a week, and then he was a trainer for a couple of other days a week, and then he had his sort of fifth day off, which was the part of him going into retirement. What that allowed the company to do was, A, it drove him significant improvements to quality because you had somebody who they could spot if there was something that wasn't right, just because that intuition and, as you say, that domain knowledge is incredibly difficult to replace. Then by using those examples as references for training, he was able to train the people how to spot those issues going forward. What we need to look at is adopting a circular economy for people as well. It's not just about making products that we can reuse. It's about creating roles for people that have been there, done that, got the proverbial T-shirt, and having them step into a different role, maybe as a consultant, maybe as a different type of service provider to the company where we pay them on a different sort of salary basis or something like that, and they bring that knowledge back into it. I don't think there's a right way to do this or a wrong way to do this, but that was certainly an example that sat with me in that this guy would otherwise have been put out to pasture and put to one side, but by bringing him in as a quality officer, he was not trained as a quality officer, but he just walked the shop floor watching how they were doing things and then took notes and identified the issues, and then he would train the guys for 2 days at the end of the week. It came full circle.
We've touched on technology, and it's interesting this because one of the first analyst reports I wrote was back in the mid-1980s looking at expert systems where British Coal and British Rail had done exactly this. They'd taken domain knowledge that encapsulated that domain knowledge within the expert systems, which today we would call artificial intelligence. But technology is a double-edged sword. If we talk to a lot of manufacturers, and we do as an organisation, one of the things we find is that manufacturers are terrified of changing technology. They hear a lot about cybersecurity, and the one thing if you're a manufacturer is that machine stops, you have no revenue coming in the door. But at the same time, as you said, that machinery is getting old and is down more than it's not. So as we look at new generations of technology, we see an awful lot of sensors, a lot of IoT coming in. We see a lot of speed, a lot of new ways of doing things. How do we make the technology fit the way the organizations work, but then still take them on that journey, that evolution of the way they function? But do that in such a way that it doesn't terrify them over cost, complexity, and skills.
The software industry has a big role to play here. as a general rule, the software industry has been complicit in the lack of adoption of new technology in manufacturers. Because what we've done in the past is we've made technology solutions incredibly powerful, but also incredibly complex. It's the old adage of taking a sledgehammer to crack a walnut. It normally ends in tears, and you don't actually get what you were looking for when you set out to do that. The other thing that we've done as an industry is, if we're not making it incredibly complex, we've gone down the other route where we've tried to oversimplify things, and we've said, here's something, and unless you fit in this cardboard box that has these dimensions, well, it's kind of round peg in square hole. We're trying to find ways of mitigating that as an industry to make technology more consumable by businesses, but we've now gone down the route where we've created a whole bunch of frameworks. Everybody's talking about frameworks. The problem with a framework is it's kind of like giving a child a box of Lego and they can do anything that they want. Not everybody's going to want to follow the instructions because not everybody's the same. One of the things that we've been trying to do, and I think it's partially because of how we've been engaging with customers, is we're looking at taking a step back and we're almost going back to the point of, what do you want the outcomes to be? We're starting to ask about outcomes, which is a big change for software industries. Software industry used to sit there and we used to think, well, what do people want? Oh, they want this. And then we'd go and we'd develop that and we'd bring it to them and they'd all go, well, wait a minute, that's not what we wanted. We can't use that. If you look at a car manufacturer, if they did that, quite often or not, people would talk with their feet. The car wouldn't sell, etc., etc. But with software, people just assume that we know what we're doing. The industry is now taking a different approach and we're almost going and we're saying, how can we provide point solutions that address the core five issues? I don't think we have to address all 10 issues at the same time. We should be addressing the top five and then moving on to the next five and then the next five, because there'll be new ones that pop up every time. So I think that's the one thing that we need to do. Coming back to your point about manufacturers being different and they want to do different things and things like that, we talk about the proliferation of the cloud and everybody talks about ERP in the cloud and things like that. And one of the reasons why we've seen financials and HR and CRM proliferation in the cloud is because people are, strangely enough, more receptive to those solutions being in the cloud. They're less risk averse. It doesn't matter if I can't pay my AP or my suppliers in time and I'm a couple of weeks late, I'll run the risk. Or it doesn't matter if I can't do my HR reviews or I can't enter the latest customer visit report. But as you say, as soon as it comes to there's a downtime on my manufacturing floor, people won't accept that, because if there's downtime, there's nothing happening in the business. There's no general ledger entries. There's nothing like that. Over time, we'll see a couple of things happening, which will hopefully allow us to address this. One is looking at all the analyst reports that are out there from Gartner, IDC, and Forrester, and others of the ilk. They've readjusted their forecasts. Cloud adoption within manufacturing and distribution is not expected to exceed more than 65% in the next 5 years, which is a massive turnaround. You look at service-based industries, it's close to 85, 95%. We're recognizing that now as a challenge. We're also recognizing that there are certain systems that people just won't put in the cloud immediately, like manufacturing execution systems, automated shop floor data collection. Why? Because even the minutest bit of latency or risk for downtime has manufacturers scared. They're very risk averse. And we have to bear in mind that most manufacturers are completely risk averse as well. Yes, will technology help that? I think so, definitely. Will 5G technology help with that? Certainly it will. Will the robustness of cloud platforms help with that? Definitely it will. But I think there's still a point where IBM's global business services team did an analysis of manufacturers. And strangely enough, one of the things that came out of that report is that people don't want to be in a box. They want to be able to customize their solution. We went through a period where customization was bad and nobody would accept that. But it's almost come full circle now that every manufacturer, doesn't matter what they make or what they do, thinks that they are different. Are they different? Well, that's a subject of interpretation. It's probably a subjective discussion. But if you're stamping out metal, there's really only a few ways that you can stamp out metal. But the way that the manufacturer delivers those capabilities or delivers the product to their customer may be vastly different. And they want to be able to customize. So I think that's a big trend that we're going to see, which is going to help technology adoption and make it less scary. And we have to provide, in this instance, the frameworks that allow them to do that in a controlled fashion, that don't lock them in place like they were 10 years ago, where you were locked in these heavy customizations.
But we've seen part of that. We've seen the disintermediation of their retail chain. Instead of going through multiple levels of intermediaries, they're now willing to go direct to the public. They're willing to allow much more customization of the product depending on order size. ERP, though, has been slow to be taken up. And ERP isn't necessarily a front-end challenge, but it's about a supply chain challenge. We've seen metals companies admit to forging the quality of metals that have gone into goods, and that has caused big problems for manufacturers going further up that chain. We know that the regulations that we're having to deal with want much more start to finish. Where did this raw material come from? What product did it end up? And consumers are beginning to ask for that, not necessarily in manufacturing. Their focus tends at the moment to be much more about food, medicine, things that touch them deeply. How do we push ahead with the back-end systems while we slowly begin to replace those front-end systems, get new technology in place, tie the digital twins into the manufacturers who can help us with other parts of this, and bring them along in a risk-lowered environment, because there will always be risk.
I think the best way of tackling this challenge is almost to look at changing this idea of the supply chain and talking about it as a value chain. Where can I, as a company, start to add value to that chain? I think that's a fundamental shift in terms of the way that people think about things. We tend to associate the supply chain as all about supply and demand, and it's about delivering things to the next person. Whereas you look at most companies today, you're right about the disintermediation of the supply chain process, but part of that is because they're not getting the value from either the people before them or after them in the chain. So they're looking to add value, which is why we see manufacturers transitioning from being a manufacturer to a distrifactor, somebody who's doing a little bit of both. We see this idea of value-added services being delivered. So I deliver a product, but I also deliver the services to commission that product, to educate you on that product. It's why we see new types of business models popping up around rental and leasing and things like that. How do we do that from a technology perspective? Well, one is we've got to make ERP significantly easier to consume. And this is where I think the cloud has a role to play. But we need to start to think about the constructs of how we develop ERP. For too long, ERP was this concept of these monolithic systems that you kind of dropped in, 2 years of pain. ERP didn't stand for enterprise resource planning. It stood for expensive, resource intensive, and painful. Let's be honest, anybody who's worked with an ERP project knows that. But now there's an expectation that with the cloud, in the consumer world, I can pick up my mobile phone and I can say, I want to subscribe to that service. And I get that. Oh, I want Spotify. I want Netflix. I want that service, I want that service. Businesses are starting to expect the same thing as more and more of their leadership is changing, and we see more of these Gen X's and Gen Z's coming through. They're starting to say, well, why can't I just switch on a service in the cloud? Why does it have to be this major effort that I have to go through? And that's where vendors of ERP solutions need to look at how they're doing things. We need to almost go down the route of adopting this idea of breaking down these monolithic applications into services that people can subscribe to as and when they need them. That kind of goes a little bit in the face of ERP because you want everything in one system, but you look at the way that companies are doing things, not everything needs to be in the cloud. Not everything needs to be on-premise. There's a balance somewhere in the middle where it could be a hybrid cloud offering where specific services or capabilities which you may want to try before you buy. Imagine being able to say, you know what, I want to try and do that and subscribe to that, test it, work with it, and then implement that into your processes. That would change the way that we deal with these applications. There is a fundamental business shift that's taking place. We've spoken about this idea of value-added services and things like that. But one of the biggest transitions that I can certainly see in manufacturing companies, in agriculture companies, in distribution companies is they're even changing the way that they fundamentally do business from an accounting perspective, because now they want to be able to measure cradle to grave profitability on a product, profitability on services. It brings with it a different sort of way of running the business. Gone are the days where you've had different cost centers and you tracked all your cost centers. We're moving to an idea where you have this constraintless organization where there are resources coming in from various areas of the organization working together in virtual teams. Well, we've been doing this for thousands of hours probably in the form of projects. This is where businesses are changing. Pretty much 85% of every manufacturing company that I speak to or every distribution company that I speak to is talking about running projects to refurbish these old machines. There's an investment there. They need to track that investment. They need to make sure that they have the right resources involved. They have to plan that across the organization. What is the impact on production? What is the impact on customer satisfaction if I can't deliver products in time because I'm switching out machines? We see global expansion. They need to set up new plants. They need to go into joint ventures. They want to manage complex contractual relationships, joint ventures, etc. They can do that through projects. And it's changing the way that companies do things fundamentally. They're not just running linear accounting like the way that we used to, where you record something against a cost center and once a month you look at the cost center. Yes, versus budget, this cost center is okay. You now want to actually see the impact across the entire organization. How many resources have we used from other teams? Have we used more resources than what we planned? Why did we do that? And then once you do that, you create a baseline for, now we've done this product development or this new service development or implemented this machine, where are there efficiencies that can be gained going forward? That is something that as an industry, we haven't necessarily enabled manufacturers to do either, but this is a big area of focus for, we're certainly taking our product going forward, and where I think manufacturers and distributors and agricultural companies want us to go. They're actually pulling us there, which is interesting because previously it was the vendor delivers X, Y, and Z, and you go, oh, wow, that's fantastic, and everybody uses it or tries to. Now it's a case of consumers or customers and businesses are driving where software is going, and they're driving it because they want ease of use. They want services that they can subscribe to and switch on and off, and the cloud is a great enabler for that. The cloud is only an enabler if businesses see it that way and they get past the idea of, well, if it's not on a box on my premises. So this kind of talks to that idea of how do we mitigate risk? Well, you look at platforms like Microsoft Azure and Amazon's AWS and things like that. There is thousands and thousands of hours of expertise that's gone into developing those. Where can a manufacturer with 200 employees set up an environment that scales the way an AWS environment does? That has the security that an AWS environment has, that has the on-call NOC engineers to manage that environment, that has the ability to fend off cyber attacks the way that these guys do. Most organizations can't do that. This is where the cloud becomes an enabler of that process, and we need to actually start to recognize that. One of the other things that people tend to forget about, and I think this is one of the things that we tend to look past, is that traditionally software acquisitions for ERP has been a lot of upfront cost, and then you implement it and you stay there for 7 years and you don't move. You don't get any of the benefits that you would in a cloud environment. Where we could help manufacturers is by saying you don't have that significant capital investment cost, but you'd planned for that in any case. So why not invest that in new machines and new technology and use the platform that you're getting from these vendors to help you take advantage of that and to manage that process. So instead of it just seeing it as, oh, I'm saving a whole bunch of cash up front because I'm going to subscription, why not see it as an opportunity to invest the cash because you were prepared to do it in any case. Instead of investing it in an ERP, put the ERP up in the cloud, take that money and invest it in those new machines so that you have not only the benefits of a new ERP solution and all the efficiencies that that will bring with it, but also you're getting the machines out of the production line that were breaking down every 2 minutes, so they weren't very efficient in any case. That's the reverse side of the double-edged sword where we can actually get some real benefits from this going forward.
The one final takeaway I got from the report was a positivity. And if we're going to rebuild manufacturing, it seems that all the things we've talked about, people are actually starting to do. So Rob, thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure.